All right. Yeah, thank you, Niyash. So, so I just want to introduce these two papers that we posted last week. This is was joint work me and Neil, and Kieran Finn was a master's student of ours a couple of years ago. And then I want to get to I don't know really what to make of this, but just yesterday there was another paper posted that claims observational evidence for the dark matter candidate that we predicted from the so-called ANITA experiment, which is a cosmic ray experiment. So I'll tell you about that a little bit.
Experimental confirmation in record time.
Experimental confirmation in record time.
Increases our caution.
Yeah. We'll see. You'll see. The error bars are big. So I just wanted to start with a very, very brief cartoon picture. So here is the universe. Okay, and the upper slice is today, and the lower slice, you know, so we look back, and observationally we see back to some lower slice, which, yeah, it depends on how you define it, but roughly a second after the Big Bang, we really have observational evidence that the universe was described very, very well by a spatially flat FRW metric with tiny Gaussian scalar perturbations in the so-called growing mode, and then and so far no tensor perturbations or vector perturbations. And so that very simple initial state is clearly some important clue about the beginning of the universe. And the question is, what is it saying? The vast majority of cosmologists believe that what it's saying is that that in order to explain that simple initial state, you should imagine that before that surface there was a hypothetical epoch of inflation, during which the scale factor expanded exponentially, and that is claimed to help establish the simple initial conditions that we see. Okay, so we want to take a different view of that clue, a different possible interpretation, which is that another thing to say about that very simple initial state is that, well, so first of all, it's saying that if you did follow it back, if you just kept on going back to the, if you just kept extrapolating 1 second further to the singularity that appears to be in our past, it's a very special sort of singularity. So it's a purely vial singularity. In other words, the metric is just the flat metric, the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu, times a conformal factor, and that conformal factor just vanishes for a moment at tau equals zero, where tau here is the conformal time. And apart from that, it's very simple and analytic in that vicinity. So, and then even when you include the scalar perturbations and the lack of observed vector and tensor perturbations, another way to interpret the scalar perturbations, vector and non-vector and tensor perturbations that we see is that we see exactly the perturbations that don't mess that story up. Okay, that keep the singularity of this purely vial type and analytic. So, we propose to interpret instead of the first radical option appending inflation, we propose to do another radical thing, which is to take the hint at face value that it's exactly the conditions one needs to follow the solution right through the Big Bang. Go ahead and do that. And then see if that gives us a new perspective on things. And, well, it does. You know, so the first thing we notice, if we do that, is that suddenly the space-time has a new isometry compared to an ordinary FRW background. Okay, so, you know, an ordinary FRW background, the isometries would be spatial translations, three spatial rotations, and then spatial parity. And then now, when we follow the metric through the bang, we suddenly find that the extended metric has an additional symmetry, additional isometry, which is a time reversal with respect to the conformal time. And so that means that you can do a little. It's easy to check that if you just like the normal CPT theorem says that any local Lorentz invariant real action you write down on a flat Minkowski background will be invariant under CPT, and you can show that there is exactly the same thing is true for an FRW background with an extra time reversal isometry, like we have here. Okay, and so that suggests that there's usually a problem with in Minkowski space, the isometries of Minkowski space for space-time translations, six Lorentz transformations, and then P and T are enough to uniquely determine a vacuum that respects those isometries. But in a more general curve spacetime, famously, the vacuum becomes ambiguous. Different observers in different parts of the spacetime will make different choices about what the vacuum state is, what the natural vacuum state is. And there are not, in general, enough isometries to prefer one vacuum over another. What we show is that now, in this case, there is a CPT invariant vacuum. So it becomes possible to take the hypothesis that there's this basic symmetry, So it's just sort of following your nose. The universe appears to have this structure that if you just naively continue it, the conditions are just right so that the actual extended analytically continued background has this extra time reversal invariance. There's therefore the quantum field theory living on that background is CPT invariant. And so it becomes natural to hypothesize that the state of the universe does not spontaneously violate that CPT symmetry. Okay, so that's going to be the idea. I want to take that hypothesis and then see what it predicts about the universe. It explains some things that we see about our universe, and then there are other things that, it may or may not explain. There's still work in progress. But so let me.
That picture to be taken literally, there's a singularity at tau equals zero, or
that is my cartoon picture, but yes, I'm literally taking A to be like this near the bang. So A passes through zero at the bang. Doesn't bounce at a finite scale factor.
So you have to say what it means, how you define quantum field theory or in such a background.
Very good, very good. Indeed. So you're absolutely true. Yes. It's a very interesting point, and I want to talk about things in a different order than that. So I'll be getting to that later in the talk. So I want to first talk. Let's go for it. Somehow to preface. This singularity. I want to say it's really an it's in some ways analogous to the black hole, more like the black hole horizon than the actual black hole singularity. It seems a lot more singular than it at first glance than I think it really is. And to in particular to show the CPT theorem on this background, well, let's set aside quantum field theory for a second. The usual CPT theorem is a statement about local Lorentz invariant real actions defined on such and such a background. That there's no confusion about how to define. And then to prove the theorem, it's purely group theoretic. I mean, it's purely algebraic. It really makes no reference to exactly what's going on in the vicinity of the bang. Having said that, what we'll see is that you're tempting me to say more now than I. Let me proceed. Okay, so to just explain a little bit more concretely what I mean by the CPT invariant vacuum. So here I'm just going to be working purely at the level of QFT on curved spacetime. So quantum fields on a purely classical background. And then the idea will be, to calculate the quantum corrections to that. But the idea is that they'll be mild. This classical calculation, we believe, basically gets the story right. The part of the story that I'm about to tell you. So here's the action for a free spinner. Let's just start with that. On an FRW background with mass m. And in the second line there, I've just rewritten that in terms of the lowercase psi as the violent invariant spinner, a to the 3/2 capital psi. And m is a constant, but mu here, the effective mass of psi, when I rewrite it in the second line, is the scale factor times m. So it's a time-dependent thing. So if the scale factor is proportional to t, then mu is also proportional to tau, I should say, the conformal time. Okay. So to quantize a field on a massive field, we just proceed as we usually do in QFT and curved spacetime. We want to expand the field psi in terms of a complete basis of solutions of the
question. This is for general scale factor.
Yeah. So we want to expand on this in terms of a complete basis of solutions of that Dirac equation. And so that's what I've done in this line here. So here, psi of p, h, and x is the positive frequency solution with momentum p and helicity h. And psi c is the corresponding charge conjugate solution. And the coefficients in front, a and b, dagger, are the annihilation and creation operator for the corresponding particle and antiparticle of momentum p and helicity h. Okay, and so now again, the issue is that I said that psi are the positive frequency solutions, but on a curved background, and in particular on the curved FRW background that we're interested in, there is no invariant notion of what positive frequency is. So in particular, observers living in the far future, like us, our notion of positive frequency means the solutions that look like positive frequency up here, I'll call those psi plus. Similarly, observers who lived in the far past would define a different basis of solutions. Their positive frequency solutions that would look like positive frequency down here. I call those psi minus. And if you expand in terms of these functions, the corresponding creation and annihilation operators A plus and B plus define a vacuum 0 plus. This is the vacuum that we would define in this room today, the late time observer's vacuum. It's just defined to be the vacuum annihilated by the A plus and B plus. And similarly, the early time observers at long before the bang would define a different vacuum, 0 minus, namely the state in Hilbert space that's annihilated by all of the A minus and B minuses. And so now the important point is that neither of these vacua, either the in vacuum or the out vacuum that we would use to define the notion of particle number in this room, is CPT invariant. These two vacua are inequivalent, and they're exchanged by CPT, and therefore neither of them is invariant under CPT. So the first thing that we show is that there's another vacuum, which is the CPT invariant vacuum. I say the. Really, the statement is very closely analogous to De Sitter space, that if you look at De Sitter space and you ask for the vacua that respect all of the De Sitter isometries, there's actually a one-parameter family of those, the so-called alpha vacua, and then there's a special one, the so-called Bunch-Davies vacuum, that is preferred in various ways, and that's usually considered the physically relevant one. There's a very closely analogous story here. There's a one-parameter family of these CPT invariant vacua, or there's a continuous family, I should say, and in a very closely analogous way, there's a preferred vacuum, and that's the one that I'll be considering in this talk. So there, the positive frequency solutions in that preferred vacuum are basically the sum of the outgoing and ingoing solutions. But then if you just naively take the sum, you find that it's not properly normalized. You have to add some corresponding normalization factor, 2 cosine of some angle chi of p. And then you can show that, okay, so none of these three vacua are equivalent. And the important thing is that if we hypothesize, so the idea is supposed to be that the universe, when we analytically continue it through the bang, suddenly has this time reversal isometry. So there's this preferred vacuum, the CPT invariant one. We're hypothesizing that the universe is in this vacuum. And then if we take the expectation value of our number operator, the late time number operator that we would define in this room to determine how many particles are in this room or in the universe at this late time, the expectation value of it with respect to the state of the universe, the hypothesized state of the universe, the CPT state, is sine squared of chi, where chi is the same angle that we needed to do the normalization over here.
So by this chi, do you want to define it somewhere
around? So you can think of chi. One way to define chi is that so all these solutions have to satisfy some normalization condition. They're Wronsky and all has to be the same. So that's in order that all of these creation and annihilation operators satisfy the usual creation and annihilation operator anti-commutation relations. So we can solve for the late time and early time modes, take their linear combination, and find that to normalize them we have to divide.
Do you have a functional form of it?
Well, I will for a particular, when I take a particular A of P and A of tau, then we'll solve for that.
Just for clarity, if it was massless, then you wouldn't have this.
Right? That's right. Yeah, that's if it was massless, that exactly.
Massless, then chi be 0.
Yeah, okay.
You don't require the background to be geodesically complete or connected.
Well, when in this FRW case, it is geodesically complete after you follow it through. It's just tau and x now both run from minus infinity to infinity. I don't know about require, but in the actual cosmological case, it is.
Certainly, in the second conformal frame, it's just a time-dependent mass on Minkowski. It's just geodesically complete as Minkowski.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I was going to discuss this later, and this gets back to Raphael's earlier question, but a preferred way to think about this, our preferred way to think about this, is in another completely equivalent conformal frame in which, it's just completely equivalent. It's just a change of variables, but in that frame, the metric is just the Minkowski metric, and then like Neil says, the thing that happens, the cost you pay, is that every bare mass term you had in the original frame, in the Einstein frame Lagrangian, every constant mass term you had becomes a time-dependent mass that passes through zero at the moment of the Big Bang. So all the masses pass through zero.
Do you mean there's no singularity there, or is it still singular?
So. Again, this is kind of, let me get back to this at the end, but I want to say that there's purely a Weyl singularity. So in the normal interpretation, that is to say in normal Riemannian geometry, you do regard that as a singularity because the Ricci tensor blows up, the Ricci scalar blows up. So but because it's purely of this Weyl type, because it's really secretly just coming from the conformal factor in front of the metric passing through zero momentarily.
So Ricci is kind of zero here.
You mean Riemann squared or something?
No, Ricci.
Ricci is zero. Just if A is T, Ricci is zero.
Oh, true. Yeah, true. True. That's true. That's true. Yeah. Sorry. But scalar curvature invariance blow up. Yeah.
So you're talking about spatial, conformal factor in front of the spatial metric or the space-time metric?
Space-time.
The space-time metric in Weyl in conformal coordinates is just A squared times A to mu nu. Okay, so somehow this is the idea. The idea is that there is this preferred CPT invariant vacuum, and the particle number that we would see in this room, if the universe was in this state, is just this simple form, and which can be calculated by that method. So let's, yeah.
First, a small thing. You're assuming flat, spatially flat, k equals zero.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And then, but is the statement that we actually are in that?
Although I don't think that matters actually. I mean, if the universe was not spatially flat, that doesn't affect anything. The only thing that's going to matter is what the geometry of the universe is, close and deep in the radiation era. So what really matters is what the universe is doing during the period between plus or minus one Compton period after the Big Bang, basically, where the Compton period is the Compton wavelength over C for any massive particles in the game.
So when you say that the state, quantum state is that, you really mean at that time the quantum state was this favorite state?
No, sorry, good point. Yeah, so I'm thinking in the Heisenberg picture. So I'm thinking the quantum state is fixed, operators are evolving.
Okay.
And so the quantum state is this dude, and then this is the late time number operator.
I mean, that's fine, but there's this thing called collapse of the wave function or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, if the state was literally that, we'd be in a spherically symmetric, there'd be no galaxies, right? I mean, so it doesn't matter really which picture we talk about it in. We have to say there was some sort of measurement like, I mean, this gets into quantum foundations, really. We'd have to say there's some sort of measurement-like activity. That
this is going to be the zeroth order approximation.
But the physics is really for the early times. That's what I'm trying to ask. It's not resting on what, for example, does it matter whether in late times the universe stabilizes its radius or whether it's to sit or, I mean, those would influence. They would seem to influence the choice of what you call vacuum, late time vacuum.
I don't think so, actually. I think the Bogoliubov transformation relating these three guys is completely dominated by it doesn't, for example, depend on whether there's a late time cosmological constant or not. It's completely determined by the fact that in this other frame, the masses of the particles are varying in time. If they weren't, then nothing would happen. The vacuum would just be the Minkowski vacuum. But because they are, there is this non-trivial change of vacuum between in and out. But that change, that Bogoliubov transformation, is dominated by this moment in time, one Compton period after the bang for any massive particle. See what I mean? So,
he's right that in principle.
So it is dominant.
In principle, the choice of vacuum is a global choice.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying in practice, what's going on, what's governing it is that new term.
Mm-hmm.
And that new term is only non-adiabatic over a short interval of time.
Mm-hmm.
Late time is adiabatic anyway. And
right.
You don't get any particle creation or anything. So.
Yeah, it's
non-adiabaticity is just around the bang.
Right, and in fact, not at the bang. It's really not the only non-adiabaticity happens at these two bumps, basically before and after the bang, roughly. Okay, so let's go a step further and now imagine, hypothesize see what this predicts if the only matter in the universe is the standard model of particle physics, where when I say standard model here, I've included a right-handed neutrino in each generation. So here's the sort of summary of the particles in the standard model. There's the SU3 times SU2 times U1 gauge bosons. There's the fermions, the left-handed quark doublet, so up left and down left. There's the corresponding right-handed quarks, upright and downright. The left-handed lepton doublet, nu left and e left. And the corresponding right-handed leptons, nu right and e right. And the indices I here are supposed to remind us that there's each of those comes in three copies, three generations. And then there's the Higgs.
Would you like to use the hockey stick?
Oh yeah, maybe that's a good idea. And then there's the Higgs boson. So in this model, there's only one dark matter candidate here, which is that there's only one particle here that we haven't detected but can still be stable. And that is, it's still possible for one, at most one, of these right-handed neutrinos to be stable. Okay, so we're going to assume, let's assume that guy is stable. So that is equivalent to saying that the standard model Lagrangian, the couplings in it, respect this symmetry under if nu right one, the first generation, is the stable one, nu right one goes to minus nu right one. Okay, so am I going crazy or is the board shaking?
It's the air conditioning, it is.
Okay.
But you might be going crazy as well.
Yeah.
It's not at all.
So.
Leo, I think your statement about the symmetry is only true for renormalizable terms, right? You could.
What statement about the symmetry?
Well, you said if it's stable, that's equivalent to it being invariant under symmetry. But I think if you add high dimension operators, it can be.
Stable without being symmetric, you mean?
Yeah, or the other way around, actually. It can be.
Unstable while still being symmetric?
Yeah.
I'll have to think about it.
Yes, I think it's true.
Stability definitely implies that Z2. Is that
for four-dimensional terms, isn't that true?
Yeah. Well, in other words, if that Z2...
Well, it would imply other things. Yeah, no, it would imply more, right, than just the Z2.
Yeah.
Strained on high dimension.
Yes, maybe
so.
Maybe so. Maybe that, yeah.
Equivalent.
Yeah. For the renormalizable part of the Lagrangian, for the
right.
then that's
true.
Yeah. Okay. So you know, if getting back for a second to Niyayish's question, because I jump over what he wants here. So in the case where, so now let's specialize to the case. The cosmologically relevant case is where we're solving the Dirac equation at the, on the second line there, where mu is just proportional to tau. Okay. So in that case, these solutions are, the equation is exactly solvable, and the solutions are these parabolic cylinder functions, special functions. They're very nice functions. They're also called the confluent hypergeometric functions, basically.
What is tau?
Tau is the conformal time for the FRW metric. So the time that we're working in the coordinates where the time reversal symmetry is tau goes to minus tau, where tau is the conformal time. It's the coordinates in which the metric just looks like a squared times the Minkowski.
What is real function
tau? Oh, sorry. Here is the Lagrangian for a massive thinner.
Yeah.
This m is a constant, but then I've just made a coordinate change here to this spinner psi. And then when I do that, the Lagrangian looks like this, but this mu is the effective mass is now this time-dependent combination, A times M. So if A is proportional to tau near the bang in the radiation era.
Why isn't A dynamical particle?
So I'm just doing quantum. I'm doing quantum field theory on curved space time. So
now you're. I mean, how is scale factor entering mass?
Maybe go back one slide.
Yes, but why is it? Why doesn't it turn into a dynamical particle? Why are you adding a degree of freedom to your problem? Why are you adding a dilaton to your problem?
So this is really just in the same sense that So in the approximation that's being taken that I'm doing in this talk, this is quantum field theory and curved space-time. So I'm treating the fields as quantum fields, but the metric is some fixed specified background. I'm taking the radiation-dominated background in particular, the FRW background. So because of that, because it's on this time-dependent background, there's some explicit time dependence in the metric, in the action, in the Lagrangian. And I've just when you do a change of variables, exactly where that explicit time dependence shows up, well, it moves around, but it's always somewhere. You can't get rid of it.
I don't know what that means. If I have an observer and at a certain time I measure the mass, what do I measure?
I think this is just a mathematical change of variables.
It is. There actually is a physical interpretation, which I'll let me get back. There's a very nice physical interpretation, which I wanted to talk about later. But for now, I wanted you to just think of it as just a change of variables. I've just switched from working in terms of the ordinary spinner that you would first write down to this new guy, which is this explicit time-dependent scale factor times the original field. So psi and phi psi and little psi are genuine fields. A is just this time-dependent function from the background.
Latham, just to check, are there really absolute values everywhere, or do I really want to let that go negative?
That's a very good point. So really, what I want, really, I'm going to say later that for now, yeah, in this expression, you can think of there as being absolute values everywhere. But really, I want to say this is the more fundamental object. This is the spinner in the vial frame in which things are non-singular, and it's when you change to the normal frame where the masses are constant that's. It's in that frame that things go singular at the bang. So in some sense, there is something funny going on when A goes to zero there, and when A becomes negative. But that funniness is exactly related to why that's exactly why I claim things appear to go haywire at the bang in the normal frame. It's very analogous to when you go close to the horizon in the Schwarzschild metric, but you stick to Schwarzschild coordinates. Things appear to go haywire, but there's a change of coordinates that lets you follow things through.
I'm not convinced on that, but you're going to tell us about that later. So that's
okay.
So very quickly, you said it's just a change of variables, but then you require a Jacobian in any case, which in this case is field dependent. And that might get haywire as you escape back to zero, right?
Jacobian isn't field dependent.
For the change of variables.
It's not field dependent.
Well, it's exactly this. So indeed, the Jacobian goes to zero in Einstein. This, you're absolutely right. This thing goes to zero in the normal frame you use, in the normal frame in which the masses are constant. That's why that frame is bad. There is this other frame in which the...
I think he means a different Jacobian. He means Jacobian in going from capital Psi to small Psi.
You mean the Jacobian of the space-time coordinate transformations or of the field transformation?
It's not. It's Jacobian. It's not field dependent. It's a linear transformation.
But, okay, I thought A was a metric dependent.
It is, but it's a background, fixed background. It's not field dependent.
Okay, so if you use those parabolic cylinder functions, you can extract what that angle chi is. It's basically, I haven't written the explicit formula for it, but it's exponential of minus pi p squared over a constant, which,
Can I ask you a question? So I mean, I think I understand what you're doing, but you cannot actually produce massless particles here, right, as you were saying.
Right.
You cannot, so then where do you get the radiation from?
That's a good question. So this whole calculation only is valid, first of all, for particles that are free, can be treated as free particles on the space-time background for at least this period where this necessary period near the Big Bang, where the sort of crucial adiabaticity violation is taking place. So they need to be free particles that are free until before and after one Compton time. One Compton period before and after the Big Bang. So the heavy neutrinos are the only Standard Model particles like that. So the whole rest of the mix of stuff in the Standard Model is all coupled together in a way that this calculation can't handle. So that
all of that stuff is just treated like a perfect fluid.
Exactly, right.
Treated like what?
A perfect fluid.
But I mean, it is, but in principle, so you don't know what the state is.
In principle, it should be calculable by this same method. That's right.
That's mm-hmm.
Okay. So what you can calculate then is that, again, using the expression on the previous slide for the expectation value of the late time number operator, if the universe is in the CPT invariant vacuum, you can calculate this dimensionless ratio, the number density of dark matter particles divided by the entropy density of the radiation. And it's given by some dimensionless constant, which is some twos and pis and g star, the number of degrees of freedom in the Standard Model, times the dark matter mass over m Planck to the 3/2. So from that, you can figure out what the dark matter mass has to be in order to match the observed dark matter abundance today. And it's this number, 4.8 times 10 to the 8 GeV, which I'll get back to in a minute, because this is there was this paper, which I don't yet know what to make of, that appeared on the archive yesterday, claiming to have detected two showers in the vicinity of that energy. So, the idea is that if you take that Dirac equation with mu is equal to tau, the conformal time, the solutions are these confluent hypergeometric functions. So there's some, now if you ask for the ones that are positive frequency at late times, those are a certain set of those hypergeometric functions. The ones that are positive frequency at early times are a different set. The ones that lead to, but neither of those give rise, I forget if you, I don't know if you were in the room yet when I explained this, but not, if you take, you know, on a curved background, different observers at different times will disagree about what the positive frequency functions are here. These are supposed to be the positive frequency functions in front of A. The late time observer will choose functions, and their corresponding annihilation operators will define a certain vacuum, 0 plus. The early time observers will choose a different set of functions and get a different vacuum, 0 minus. And what I explained was neither of those things, neither of those vacua, respect the isometries of the background. They are not invariant under the isometries of the background. They're inequivalent, and they transform into each other. There is a vacuum which is invariant under the isometries, and it is this different vacuum. It uses these different solutions, this different definition of quote unquote positive frequency, which is basically just the sum of the outgoing modes and the ingoing modes times this divided by 2 cosine chi, the normalized. And now the idea is just like in black hole evaporation, or just like in the calculation of perturbations from inflation, one person's number operator will have a non-zero expectation value in a different person's vacuum. So our late time number operator for the dark matter particles will have a non-zero expectation value with respect to this CPT invariant vacuum, which I'm hypothesizing is the one that the universe is actually in.
Is the Lewis energy state at the top equal to zero?
Sorry?
Does it correspond to Lewis energy state at top equal to zero?
I don't know. It's a little hard to define energy right at tau equals zero, but this is the minimum energy CPT invariant vacuum according to an asymptotic observer. That is one thing that it is. It's the. So according to us at late times, by asymptotic observer I just mean someone long after the bang, late time observer, us. So. If the universe is really in this state, then we, using this number operator, calculate that there is some non-zero abundance of particles in the universe. So if the universe had instead been in 0 plus, this expectation value would vanish. There would be no particles in the universe, but then the universe would not be in a CPT symmetric state. The hypothesis is that the universe respects CPT invariance, does not spontaneously violate it. So the universe is in this different state for which this expectation value is non-vanishing. It's the same. I don't know if you've gone through the calculation for a black hole or for inflation in this language, but it's really the same calculation. It's the sort of standard QFT and curved spacetime calculation that different people at different places in the spacetime will disagree about the notion of what zero particles is. And the statement is that if the universe is in the CPT invariant state, then we, the late time observer, who define positive frequency to mean that the function is oscillating as e to the minus I omega t in this room, we think the universe is, we think that there is some average particle density which is given by this angle, which measures the inequivalence between these two vacua. Because if these two vacua were equivalent, then no such factor would be needed to normalize things.
I think short answer to Mina's question is that the dark matter is not produced, it's there to begin with. So, because you don't actually produce it.
Where is the vacuum?
The state has the same amount of dark matter all the
time. So roughly speaking, you can say that the dark matter is gravitationally produced. It is present, according to us, due to the fact that the definition of zero particles in this room does not match the definition of zero particles according to the creation and annihilation operators, according to the number operator built from the creation and annihilation operators that define the CPT invariant vacuum.
Would it help to say that this chi is effectively a Bogoliubov coefficient?
Yes, that's true. The Bogoliubov coefficient, for example, between the in and out modes, the so-called beta coefficient is sine of 2 chi, right, exactly. Maybe that's a good way to say it. So Mina, I'm gonna push on, and I'm happy to talk more afterwards.
No, continue.
Okay. Okay. So if this particle nu one really is the dark matter, then there are a couple consequences of that. So the three light neutrinos. There's three heavy neutrinos, three light neutrinos. All of them are Majorana states. So in particular, the three light neutrinos are Majorana. And so that means that they can induce neutrinoless double beta decay. There are experiments looking for that. Unfortunately, because we don't know all of the coefficients in the neutrino part of the standard model Lagrangian, we can't predict exactly what this rate should be. But experiments are certainly in the ballpark of the plausible rate for this. So one great thing would be if we could detect those decays. The next thing is that it turns out that if this particle is stable or longer lived than the Hubble time, then the lightest of the three light neutrinos is massless. And so this will be tested with cosmological experiments. Cosmological experiments, CMB and large-scale structure experiments, are measuring the sum of the three light neutrino masses. And if this prediction is correct, that sum has to be the minimum possible value. So depending on whether neutrinos are in the normal or the inverted hierarchy, that means that the total should be 0.05 eV or 0.1 eV, and where the current limits are something like 0.2 eV. Okay, so they'll get better in the coming years. And that will be tested and will be very interesting to see which way it goes. And then so far I've been talking about the one stable heavy neutrino, which I want to have be the dark matter. The other two heavy neutrinos have to be unstable. But that's okay. They do leptogenesis, they do thermal leptogenesis in the usual way. So they can be responsible for creating the observed matter-antimatter asymmetry.
Sorry, how is the universe defined with this? How do you reheat? I mean, why isn't there more abundance of this heavy neutrino? How do you reheat?
There's no. What do you mean reheat? Do you mean there's no inflation?
In order to get leptogenesis, you have to reheat and get all the energy.
Where does the word re come from?
What happens actually here is that the same process that produces this neutrino also produces the other two heavy neutrinos. It actually produces too much of them, but the same thing that makes it stable decouples it from the thermal bath. It never talks to the thermal bath. The other guys, it's the usual story with thermal leptogenesis. They get produced in too large an abundance in the early universe, but then they equilibrate with the thermal bath before they decay. So They equilibrate with the thermal bath, they're reduced to their thermal abundance, and then after the temperature drops below their mass, they fall out of equilibrium, decay. It's the usual thermal leptogenesis story.
This produces, I have basic misconception about what I mean by lunars here. The temperature, are they produced relativistic? Are they produced non-relativistic? If they're produced relativistic, then it doesn't know anything about the mass. Why does the abundance depend on the mass? How are they produced?
So the way that all the heavy neutrinos are produced is by this quantum field theory and curved space-time effect, which, I think for the sake of getting to the rest of the talk, I should go ahead and we should discuss that afterwards. But I'm claiming that the same mechanism that produces these guys, the reason they are produced is that if you solve for the mode functions, the solutions to the Dirac equation for a massive particle on an FRW background, which is analytically continued through the bang so that it's time reversal symmetric.
Sorry, what do you mean analytical continuous? There's a singularity. How do you control the singularity? No.
I think it should just continue.
Okay.
Yeah, you've dealt with these questions.
Okay, so I mentioned that there are forthcoming observations that will hopefully test these two things. This prediction is an interesting one. There was a paper. I don't want to put too much stock in it. I haven't had a chance to really think carefully about it, but it appeared on the archive yesterday, and it's at least interesting. The basic point, you can say that they say we explain the two upgoing ultra high energy shower events observed by ANITA as arising from the decay in the Earth's core of the quasi stable dark matter candidate in the CPT symmetric universe are interpreted as arising. This is the mass that we let me just say that the idea is that there's this ANITA detector that looks for ultra-high energy neutrinos at the South Pole. And part of the detector is they have balloon-based detectors flying directly above the South Pole. And they saw these two upgoing events coming steeply out of the Earth, which is not the geometry you expect. You expect downgoing particles, and they weren't able to interpret these particles. They happen to have energies that are in the vicinity of the 480 PeV that you would get by the decay of one of these heavy right-handed neutrinos that we predict. That if these things were accumulated in the center of the Earth and decayed, you would see a 480 PeV shower. They see two upgoing events with 600 plus or minus 400 and 560 plus or minus 300 and 200. So it doesn't, I don't know. It's just thought I'd mention it. It's kind of intriguing, but I don't know how seriously to take it.
Didn't you say a minute ago your dark matter particle was stable?
That's a good point. So it only needs to be, it doesn't, when I say stable, it doesn't need to be exactly stable.
Okay.
If the Z2 is exact, and like Neil was saying, and we restrict attention to just the renormalizable part of the Lagrangian, then it's exactly stable. But really, it only needs to be sufficiently stable that it lives longer than the age of the universe. And
okay. So not quite stable, but almost.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this. So that's what they mean by quasi stable.
Do you have a notion of how often this decay should happen?
We had no prediction for it. No. I mean, as far as That's one of the things. I mean, I have trouble taking this. Well, let me start by saying I don't want to say I have trouble taking it seriously. These are very well known. These are legitimate cosmic ray and particle physics folks. Having said that, it seems like a bit of a miracle for the decay rate to be just high enough that we can observe it with the NIDA experiment. So it'll be miraculous good luck if it does turn out to be.
The observation didn't have a loss week.
What?
No.
The observation didn't have a loss week. Like, they observed it. They didn't understand what it is, and now they claim to understand.
Right.
Is there some other explanation for an upgoing event?
So they discussed this a little bit in the paper. I wouldn't be the expert to talk to about this. They found that it did not, that the naive explanation that you would give, which is that if this is the Earth, if this is the South Pole here, then an event might have entered the Earth somewhere down here, and then only interacted up in the crust. That because the attenuation at those energies of the neutrino signal as it passes through the Earth is quite large, this is many attenuation lengths, that the high energy neutrino background isn't sufficient to predict to account for the two events they saw. So they claim that the standard explanation doesn't give a high enough rate for them to have seen events of that sort. But I must say I personally don't know what to. I cannot vouch for that calculation, but. Except to say that these are legitimate guys. Okay, so
can you go back? I just want to say this is date April 1st, so just
ha. That is funny. I hadn't noticed that. That is
March 30th wasn't posted.
That is that would be very funny. That would be very funny if this if I'm on candid camera here, that would be Yeah, that's a good point. So that's how you should
cast it.
I need to move on.
So much for that paper.
Okay, now I knew I was going to be out of time here, but I didn't know I was going to be quite this out of time. So let me just, I'll maybe just say a couple of things in a blitz on a final slide here, and then maybe if there's time for one question about one of them or something, you feel free to ask. But so. I focused on this dark matter prediction, there are a bunch of other things that come from the same hypothesis. So you predict no primordial tensors for the reason Niyash was saying. If they're massless, I said most of the particles in the standard model are too strongly interacting for our calculation to apply, but for gravitational waves, they do apply, and like you said, because they're massless, there's no production. There's no discrepancy between the CPT vacuum and the late-time vacuum. There's also no primordial vector perturbations, primordial vorticity, which is what we observe, because that would be incompatible with CPT on the background. An interesting thing is that the scalar perturbations are forced by symmetry to be, you know, there's two solutions of the co-moving curvature perturbation R, or zeta, has two solutions. In order to explain the oscillations in the CMB, it's saying that, so one of those solutions goes to a constant as tau goes to zero, and the other one diverges as tau goes to zero. CPT kills the one that diverges and permits the one that goes to a constant, and then that's exactly the initial condition that we see in the CMB. The ringing, the famous oscillations that you see in the CMB power spectrum, are exactly, you know, that's saying certain K modes are at a node, certain ones are at an antinode when the CMB photons are released. That's exactly coming from that boundary condition. So we account for that. We don't yet claim to explain where the scale invariant power spectrum comes from, but that boundary condition, which accounts for the oscillatory features in the CMB, we do explain. And it's interesting that all of those three, the above three predictions, they all protect the Weyl character of the Big Bang singularity. So I was saying that the Big Bang has this special property that it's just the Minkowski metric times a conformal factor that briefly vanishes at tau equals zero, but otherwise is analytic there. And these are exactly the three modes that are killed here in the vector, tensor, and scalar perturbations are the ones that would mess that up. So it also says that it also implies those conditions that density perturbations grow away from the Big Bang in either direction, in either the plus tau or minus tau direction. So in that sense, the arrow of time, the thermodynamic arrow of time points away from the Big Bang in both directions. Okay. There's a natural reinterpretation of this story as saying that so if there's an excess, CPT implies that if there's a slight excess of baryons in the universe, in the positive tau part of the universe, there's the exact corresponding excess of antibaryons in the negative tau portion. And for that reason and a couple of other reasons, there's a very natural reinterpretation of the two halves of the cone as really being very closely analogous to a UU bar pair in the Stuckelberg interpretation, where an antiparticle is really just a particle where its world line is embedded so that its internal world line time is propagating in the opposite direction from the embedding time in the embedding space. There's a relation to the strong CP problem. Let me skip over that. I said I was just going to scoot through these, and then we can ask. Then maybe if there's time for one question. I want to say that the Big Bang is a very misunderstood singularity. That it's very analogous to the black hole horizon, where people thought it was much worse than it was, and it took a couple of decades for people to appreciate that by going to a different coordinate frame, you could pass right through the singularity. There's an analogous story here, where by going to a different vial frame, you can pass through the Big Bang singularity. Now, controversy about how dangerous the black hole horizon is has, of course, persisted even up until the present day. And no doubt, I can't convince you in the remaining 2 minutes that the statement is true.
On the classical level, when you talk about the horizon, there was nothing wrong. The equations, you could look at the theory, and the theory was saying, when you go to the singularity, the Big Bang, they weren't singularity. You're taking a leap of faith there.
I have not left myself enough time to answer this question in the talk, unless, well...
That's okay. I mean, we are Mark's friends, so.
Yeah. So, as I've thought more about this, I increasingly don't agree with it. So, somehow the key thing, and this is a point that was emphasized right after GR came around by Weil and then later by Dickey, is that. You know, somehow a key thing about GR is that I have a local freedom to choose coordinates. So if I choose my coordinates, the coordinates frame might be at rest in this room. And once I've chosen the coordinates to be at rest in this room, and now I ask, oh, what are the coordinates in, so there's some other seminar going on in the Andromeda galaxy. Are the coordinates over there also at rest in that seminar room over there? The answer is, GR says, I can't tell you that. You're free to choose whatever coordinates you want. You can choose ones that are at rest or not.
As long as you're not on a singularity. Yeah. If you're on a singularity, you don't have the freedom. You just take it away from you.
Yes. Let me just continue for a second. So, but in the normal formulation of Riemannian geometry, you do something with the choice of unit length, which violates that principle. So in the normal way Riemannian geometry is formulated, if I have three sticks in front of me in this seminar room, and they have three different lengths, and I pick up the one on the right, and I say I declare this to be the meter. This is 1 meter, and all things shall be measured in this unit. Now the person in the seminar room in the Andromeda galaxy, in the usual formulation of Riemannian geometry, no longer has a choice to choose which stick is 1 meter. It's forced upon them. They have to choose the meter stick so that a proton has the same Compton wavelength in meters in this room and in that room. So that is not a coordinate choice, but it is a choice of what I call vial frame. But it's analogous. It's a global choice that violates the spirit of GR. And the correct thing to do, just like Einstein, just like you can reformulate things so that you're free to make local freedom to make coordinate choices, there's a well-known way to reformulate things so that you're free to make different choices of the unit length of measure, the meter stick, in each different frame. in each different place in space-time. And that's just by the exact analog of the Stueckelberg trick. In the Stueckelberg trick, you have the Lagrangian for a massive vector field, and so it doesn't have gauge invariance, but you can introduce a scalar field to get an extra scalar field in the theory to get exactly the physically equivalent theory, but with an extra gauge invariance. You can do the exact same thing with this scale freedom. You take each dimensionful field and you replace it by a dilaton times that field, a dilaton to the field's length dimension times that field. You make that substitution everywhere in the Lagrangian. Voila, you have exactly the equivalent Lagrangian with one extra field and one extra gauge freedom, now the freedom to choose local choice of units, unit length. And when I kept referring before to maybe this gets back to both something that Mina had asked about and also Raphael had asked about. Once you do that, you can change not coordinate frame, but you can change this vial frame so that instead of choosing the frame where the mass of a particle is the same at every point in space-time, the Compton wavelength is the same at every point in space-time, because that frame goes bananas at the Big Bang, you go to a different frame which doesn't go bananas at the Big Bang. Everything is non-singular, but in that frame, the mass of a particle that in the usual frame has a constant bare mass, in that other frame, its mass, the observers closer and closer to the bang say that mass is smaller and smaller. Or in other words, its Compton wavelength is larger and larger. So they choose a shorter and shorter unit of length, basically closer to the bang, in such a way that in their frame, the metric is constant, it's the Minkowski metric, but physics is completely equivalent. In their frame, instead, the same elementary particle has a different mass close to the different Compton wavelength close to the bang in meters than what it does out here.
Yeah, but I can ask questions like, if I have a point particle, what is the equation of motion of that point particle? Let's say you're a test particle, and in one frame it's going to follow the geodesics that you expected from, say, the equivalence principle. In the other one, it would not. You also have to.
No, it's complete. It's completely equivalent. There's no distinction.
Sorry, I think maybe it's your clarify. So you think in terms of particles, but in real world there are no particles. We only have fields. But the thing that you're missing in your picture is that you're only looking at free fields. And if you have interactions, then it depends on the type of interactions. So for super renormalizable interactions, you're perfectly fine because at high energy they all go to zero. But for non-normalizable, like GR, which is, if you look at interaction times, that would blow up in your coordinate system.
So indeed, there is something very there is. So indeed, non-renormalizable terms do blow up at the bang, but that blow up. So that is a good point. But that blow up, those terms become important. Really, once you get that's there you're talking within like one Planck length of the
right.
Bang, and the interpretation in this other frame of what's going on there, is that, you know, so in this other frame, what you have is flat space time, a thermal bath, and particles whose masses are changing in time and pass through zero, and then become non-zero again, and the interpretation of that blow up is that if you take If in this other frame where things are just sitting there but the masses are passing through zero, you ask for properties of the thermal bath correlators like that on length scales large compared to the thermal length, the thermal coherence length, then the normal thermal description of that bath is perfectly good. But if you ask for correlators on very tiny length scales, small compared to the thermal coherence length, where quantum coherence becomes important, you can't just describe the thing as a classical thermal bath, then quantum effects take over. Your normal thermal predictions break down. That, in this other frame, is what that corresponds to, although the fact that all of those non-renormalizable terms are blowing up, those are really quantum effects coming and becoming increasingly important. But, you know, in that other frame, you're not led to doubt. In that other frame where you have a thermal bath and just the masses of the particles are passing through zero, there's nothing violent happening at that moment where they pass through zero. I mean, there's something interesting happening, but
if the interaction terms blow up, then you don't really have a, because you think about the gas of weakly interacting particles when you say thermal gas. But then if interactions blow up, then
which,
you have
which interactions are blowing up?
Everything, I mean, like interactions with gravitons, right?
So what I'm saying is that those interaction terms blowing up, you only use those terms in the region where in the region where you want to calculate correlators on timescales that are, or length scales that are so small that they are smaller than the they're smaller than what you need for this problem. I mean, you don't need to know how the thermal bath is behaving on the interatomic distance or in the subatomic.
Do you think that a hot gas in thermal equilibrium has divergent interactions due to
no
gravity?
No, but the thing is,
so that's what he's describing. It's a static universe with a hot gas.
No, but here, the free theory is perfectly fine. But I think my problem, as soon as you add the interactions, and then the thing is, how would A appear in the interactions? And I'm saying that there are some terms, some interactions that I guess I would call supernormalized, but those are the ones that go to zero, like the mass term, and you don't care about them. But there are some of them for which basically go as 1 over A to some power.
No, those would be the non-renormalizable.
That's right. So exactly. So those
right.
are the ones that you would worry about, like the ones that include gravity.
Would you worry about them if the universe was static and full with a hot gas?
But there is no time-dependent coupling constant. But then here...
So I'm saying there is a conformal frame in which that description is valid.
So I think...
Gravity does not come from it. That's my point.
I think the way to say, Even in flat space time, if you ask questions on sufficiently short length scales, all these non-renormalizable terms become important, including terms in gravity, and things go haywire. But we don't normally worry about that causing the destabilization of space time in this room, because we believe that for physical processes where the longer time scales and distances are the relevant ones. We don't need to ask such finely grained questions, and we can use the effective field theory on larger scales. So there's something analogous going on here. All the particle production effects I was talking about are really taking place at a time that is in the radiation-dominated epoch, but far, far after the energies far below the Planck scale. I believe it is analogous to when people initially we're stuck to using Schwarzschild coordinates, the horizon seemed very singular. A photon that had finite frequency here seemed like it must have had infinite blue shift when it came from the horizon, or a person hovering close to the horizon, it was experiencing an infinite temperature. So there a change of an appropriate change of perspective makes that go away, and I think the same thing is true.
Whether there are observables that are going bad or not. In the case of the black hole horizon, the answer is absolutely not, which eventually people figure out, just follow classical coordinate. I have followed the geodesics, and you'll see it's perfectly fine. But in this case, it looks so if I look at the acceleration between, say, two null geodesics, it's going to diverge in your stereo, unless I misunderstood it.
I think you have to be, okay, because I'm way over, I want to say this. I think it's very analogous to the black hole horizon, where every new question you ask is very confusing and requires great care when you're asking what happens in the limit that you go right next to the black hole horizon, especially if you do it in the not the most apt coordinate system. Every question that I've thought carefully through in this other context turns out to be less worrisome than it seems in the normal frame when you think about it in this new frame.
Cross a black hole horizon, I'm going to give you the choice. Cross a black hole horizon of supermassive black hole or go into the Big Bang singularity. Which one do you choose?
The Big Bang singularity still gets very hot. I still would be ripped into, my atoms would dissociate. I still would be mainly made of, I would turn into a massless gas of, nearly, relativistic gas of particles. So it's not... being ripped apart by a singularity, but it's still, you know, no picnic. I mean,
exactly the way you went in, so you should go for it.
Yeah, but that takes that. Okay.
I believe it.
First of all, just to clarify, that would violate the thermodynamic era of time in both parts of the universe. So I can't do that. If that's a nice suggestion, though. Okay. Sorry. I wanted to mention that there's been a bunch of interesting work on previous work on going through the bang. Much of it done by people at PI. So there's this one group. Wrote a series of papers, Bars, Chen, Steinhardt, and Turok. And then Keelan and Turok wrote a pair of papers, and then Barber, Koslowski, Mercati, and Sloan wrote these guys. I didn't want to forget to mention them. And okay, one thing I haven't explained here, but that is work in process, is about why is the universe flat FRW? I just assumed the flat FRW background. And why scale invariant perturbations? So anyway, that's, let me not say anything about that except that it's work in progress. Thank you. Sorry for running over.
Questions? We already have quite a few. I don't know, Rafa, it seemed like you're okay. No.
So, it went by very fast, and right at the end you explained a lot of things, but so quickly that you didn't explain them. So what?
I may have done things in the wrong order. It seemed like a good order when I was planning the talk, but.
My excuse for not asking about those. But the one you did explain to us was the sort of dark matter. So the question is, so a lot of the others depended on the exact CPT invariants, but my question is about that one specifically. Instead of assuming a CPT state, invariant state, what if you assume psi minus was the true vacuum? How different would it predictions for the dark matter have been?
Roughly, but not exactly, you would predict twice as much.
That's what
dark matter for a given mass.
So you could, it wouldn't change things that, or how would it change your dark matter candidate?
It would.
Neutrino mass.
You would roughly speaking get twice the dark matter for a given mass. So you would have to reduce the mass by a factor of 2 to the 2/3.
Because one might believe in another way that instead of this time symmetric thing, I mean, you might believe that. Mm. Sort of.
We were originally. Yeah. We originally were thinking about that, and then I have come to think that this is much better motivated, and that a lot of features of the early universe are explained better this way. So I don't think that's the way it is, but anyway, you're right that if you did it that way, you would still get production of this particle, according to our late time state.
Okay, so maybe on that note, we should wrap up. Let's thank Latham again.